Welcome to Managing Myeloma. I'm Dr. Donald Harvey. In today's presentation, I'll review pharmacotherapeutic considerations for new drug regimens in comorbid patients with multiple myeloma. In this video, I'll provide you with the information and tools necessary to effectively manage treatment-related adverse events associated with newer lenalidomide and bortezomib-based drug regimens. We'll also discuss treatment considerations when using these regimens in patients with hepatic and renal dysfunction, diabetes, or cardiovascular dysfunction, all of which can require dose modification strategies, interruption of treatment, or use of concomitant medications. Let's begin. So, induction therapy in myeloma has changed substantially over the last 5 to 10 years. There are lots of patient-specific factors to consider, including transplant eligibility for autologous stem cells, patient parameters, specifically comorbidities, which we'll talk about today, as well as other functional issues like distance from the treatment center, insurance status, and other things that we need to consider to get access to drugs. But overall, an optimal induction regimen does a number of things for the patient and for their prognosis. The first and most important thing is that it induces a deep response. An optimal regimen will induce at least a VGPR or better, because we know that depth of response yields an improvement in overall survival. It will also potentially improve their performance status. If patients feel poorly due to their myeloma, particularly with newly diagnosed disease, then a good induction regimen will help them to remove those symptoms and hopefully feel better on therapy rather than worse. Certainly will overall improve their quality of life optimally. And then for those patients who are transplant eligible, that it will have a minimum effect on stem cell mobilization. And specifically, we're referring to the timing and duration of lenalidomide. Optimally, no more than 4 cycles of lenalidomide-containing therapy are used in order to maximize stem cell yield. And we know that 3 drugs are better than 2, and we know this because of the SWOG study that was performed, and I really like this study for a variety of reasons, particularly in the context of today's presentation. One is that it included pretty much all patients, and so when you look at the eligibility criteria, these were previously untreated patients with measurable disease, including those who had free light chain only disease, and from our perspective as pharmacists, particularly those patients with renal insufficiency. Patients who had creatinine clearances all the way down to 30 mL per minute were included. Similarly, performance status of 3 patients were included if the performance status decline was due to the patient's myeloma. Overall, there are a little over 500 patients randomized to either 2 drug regimen with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in a 28-day cycle, 6 28-day cycles, or a 3 drug regimen combining bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. It's important to note as well that the bortezomib was given intravenously in this trial, and we'll talk about why that's important in the coming slides. Patients then got those 6 months of therapy and then went on to RD maintenance with lenalidomide and lower dose dexamethasone alone, with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival. There were other secondary endpoints, overall response and overall survival, but again, many of these patients were eligible for transplant, so they were stratified by both stage of disease as well as the intent to transplant. Median overall follow-up was over 2 years. Maintenance was there, and all patients received aspirin for thromboprophylaxis due to lenalidomide and venous thromboembolic risk, and all patients receiving bortezomib received antiviral prophylaxis. And to boil it down, these are the outcomes in each arm, and you can see there were significant differences in the primary endpoint of progression-free survival, with over a year difference in patients getting 3 drugs versus 2, as well as an increase in the median overall survival of about 11 months, and those were both statistically significantly different. And so that really cemented the idea that 3 drugs are better than 2 in a variety of patients. And again, to remind you, the inclusion criteria were quite broad for this study. Adverse events are listed below. There were more neurologic and sensory neuropathy adverse events with bortezomib, but again, the bortezomib in this trial was given intravenously, and we know that subcutaneous administration is as effective as intravenous, but also reduces the issues of neurologic toxicities with bortezomib in the intravenous route. Similarly, there are gastrointestinal adverse events that I believe are underappreciated when given IV, and therefore we believe here also that subcutaneous administration reduces gastrointestinal adverse events, specifically diarrhea and nausea. And similarly, other adverse events that one might see were pretty similar between the two arms. When we think about induction regimens with combining bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, we need to think prospectively about how we're going to manage patients. For bortezomib, everyone needs herpes zoster prophylaxis. For example, acyclovir 400 milligrams twice daily is an easy and convenient regimen, but is also effective. Every patient also needs a symptom-directed neurologic exam, but very importantly, a baseline neurologic exam, because we know that myeloma itself can have some neurologic implications and reduction in nerve sensory function. Lenalidomide needs renally adjusted dosing, and patient will go through that as well as risk-adapted thromboprophylaxis based on risk factors patients come into their treatment with. Dexamethasone should be ideally dosed in the morning prior to other agents, particularly bortezomib, because dexamethasone is an antiemetic. It should be dosed in the morning because it has, of course, a stimulatory side effect, and so taking it in the midday or evening hours is really not optimal, and patients need to take it in the morning. So with bortezomib and herpes prophylaxis, we know that patients who are immunocompromised are at risk of developing both herpes and zoster infections. Bortezomib does have effects on T cells as well as other cells and B cells specifically. And so acyclovir and other agents are effective at preventing herpes virus infections in these patients. And that's with or without corticosteroids. And so any bortezomib or really any proteasome inhibitor-based treatment needs acyclovir prophylaxis or some other antiviral. The vaccine in these patients is not recommended, not due to the fact that it might induce a herpes infection, but more that in general it's probably not going to be as effective because these patients are receiving therapy that can reduce their antigen response and long-term antibody production, and they have myeloma, and so their ability to stimulate a long-term memory response to a vaccine is impaired. Bortezomib can cause neuropathy. These are guidelines for dose adjustment and management of patients who may develop neuropathy. Again, the subcutaneous route is associated with less neuropathy, less frequent and less severe, but regardless, it can be seen. And so these are dose adjustments that are recommended for patients who are receiving bortezomib and may develop neuropathy. And I think the most important part to this table and most important point is that any patient who develops grade 2 neuropathy with pain or any grade 3 or grade 4 really needs bortezomib discontinuation. And we don't think about that often with grade 2 adverse events, but patients who have grade 2 with pain do need to have discontinuation of bortezomib. This is important because usually we can catch these patients sooner with good cycle-dependent neurologic examinations and an understanding of change in neurologic function as patients go on. In general, there are two strategies for managing these patients. One is to either reduce the dose and go let's say from 1.3 to 1 milligrams per meter squared twice weekly for 2 out of 3 weeks, or you can convert patients to weekly dosing from twice weekly dosing in order to minimize the bortezomib exposure should they develop grade 1 or grade 1 with pain or grade 2 neuropathy. For venous thromboembolism events, there are risk factors patients may come into treatment with independent of the addition of lenalidomide or IMID-based therapy that can also increase risk. And so these are some of the risk factors that we know of that can increase patients' likelihood of developing a VTE while on lenalidomide or IMID-based therapy. Some of these are more important than others. Certainly the history of a prior venous thromboembolic event is an important risk factor that needs to be weighed probably more than other things on here, like a chronic kidney disease. Certainly that's an issue within myeloma patients, but this is a chronic kidney disease that may be due to other factors, not just myeloma. Optimally, we would induce patients and hopefully improve their renal function, but if they do have chronic kidney disease for other reasons, they may be at slightly increased risk of developing venous thromboembolic events. Similarly, acute infection, immobilization, and other risk factors that we know of in other patients increase the risk of developing a venous thromboembolic event. And the reason this is important is because it changes our prophylaxis strategy. In some patients, we can use generally aspirin at full dose, typically 325 milligrams per day, but there is data with 81 milligrams per day as well. But if patients have more than two risk factors for venous thromboembolic events, then low molecular weight heparin at the equivalent of prophylactic doses of enoxaparin, for example, or full dose warfarin may be used. And then adding on for the idea of IMID-related therapy, and then Other therapies, less used therapies these days, like pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, can increase the risk. But in general, we're discussing IMID-based venous thromboembolic events with this presentation. The newer anticoagulants, for example, the 10A inhibitors, there's really been no prospective data. However, one would think that based on the mechanism of clot formation in these patients and the mechanism of action of these drugs, that they would be adequate and probably more than adequate prophylaxis for patients should they be on them when they're beginning induction therapy. Moving now to cytopenias and thinking about monitoring patients as they begin induction therapy, the first part of their induction treatment may be the most monitored time, because that might be the time you would see more cytopenias, thrombocytopenia, neutropenia particularly. And so in that first cycle, weekly dosing, weekly monitoring should be performed, and you may extend the interval between as patients to show how their cytopenias may or may not develop. There are standard dose reductions that are needed. Certainly bortezomib and lenalidomide have those within their product information. Specifically for neutropenia, in patients who develop grade 3 or higher, you need to make sure you're measuring their complete blood counts weekly for neutrophil counts, and consider G-CSF, which can be given in combination with lenalidomide and bortezomib. For thrombocytopenia, if the thrombocytopenia is thought to be due to bortezomib against a relatively elastic thrombocytopenia, meaning platelet counts can go down and bounce back up, and so you can maybe able to treat through those, but in patients who have grade 3 or higher, which is a platelet count of 50,000 or lower that persists, meaning it lasts for say 48, 72 hours or longer, then you may want to consider dose reductions or holding treatment. But again, if the platelet count reduction is due to bortezomib or thought to be due to bortezomib, then you may be able to treat through it and just check and see where they are at their next measurement. Anemia, these days erythropoietin and other growth factors are not used as commonly, and so transfusions are more likely to be needed for symptomatic anemia. And so those that may be different for different patients. Patients with heart failure may need transfusions at higher hemoglobins than patients who don't have comorbidities. It's important to think about renal dysfunction in this population, specifically in the induction regimen setting, but also in the relapsed and refractory setting. And so bortezomib has been used in many patients and certainly isn't renally cleared, but has been used at full dose in many patients with renal dysfunction. Data from our center and others have demonstrated that this is an effective strategy. Looking at specifically the phase 3 APEX trial of bortezomib, where patients who were included with creatinine clearances above 30, well, those patients who had clearances between 30 and 50 were compared to those with creatinine clearances above 50, and specifically asking questions around their response as well as adverse events. If you look at the overall clinical outcomes and disease outcomes for these patients, there was really no difference in the time to progression, certainly numerically lower in the patients with more advanced renal dysfunction, but the overall survival was also numerically different. That really reflects the disease burden for these patients, and my belief is not that this is an issue with bortezomib or a concern with bortezomib, but more that these patients have more advanced and aggressive myeloma. Adverse events of grade 3 or higher were no different in the two populations with preserved renal function in those patients with some degree of renal insufficiency. For lenalidomide, the reminder, the starting dose is 25 milligrams orally, and patients who have moderate impairment, which is defined by product information for lenalidomide and FDA as 60 mils per minute or lower of creatinine clearance. And it's a pretty big drop in dose, and so if you think about going from 25 milligrams to 10 milligrams daily, that's an over 50% dose reduction. And so I would think carefully about patients, for example, who have creatinine clearances above 50. Because is there really a difference in clearance and area under the curve of 25 milligrams of lenalidomide in patients who have creatinine clearances above 50? I think it's hard to say. And particularly up front, we really want to give good doses of drugs. And so we've tended to take a more aggressive approach in patients with creatinine clearances, say above 50, and give them full dose, but continue to monitor them carefully. But specifically, the product information does recommend 60 mils per minute or lower for dose reductions. The next cut point is less than 30 mils per minute. So extending the interval to every 48 hours and giving 15 milligrams a day in those patients who are not on dialysis but have clearances below 30, or those patients with end-stage renal disease, again, 5 milligrams, giving the drug after dialysis because it is removed by dialysis. Diabetes is another important consideration in patients. Certainly, there's an increased prevalence of diabetes in the population in the U.S. as a whole, and over 11 million cases in those over 65. For dexamethasone specifically in patients who are diabetic, dexamethasone is still an important drug in the treatment of myeloma. It's lymphocytic and destroys plasma cells overall, and so thinking about dexamethasone is an important factor in patients with diabetes. Glucose monitoring may need to be done more frequently. Patients may need to have add-on insulin, short-acting insulin, if they are to go above 200, for example, or more aggressively as needed, but certainly blood glucose changes can be seen in anybody taking dexamethasone, but it's of specific importance in patients with diabetes. They may also be more prone to neuropathy. That neuropathy may be the sensory neuropathy, and so thinking about bortezomib is important, but it's also an additional risk factor for renal insufficiency. If patients have advanced diabetes and myeloma, then they're sort of have two hits potentially for renal insufficiency. For patients who come into treatment with heart disease, specifically with lenalidomide, they may be at increased risk for venous thromboembolic events, particularly in those patients who have heart failure with ejection fractions, for example, below 40% or so. We might see increases in the risk of the development of clots, and so one needs to think carefully about those patients overall. In patients who are getting dexamethasone and who have heart failure or hypertension, it may be a concern for fluid retention. But really, thinking of heart disease, it's a greater concern with other agents we may use in the relapsed and refractory setting or in other settings, sort of carfilzomib and pantobinostat, for example. Other considerations in patients with myeloma, hepatic dysfunction in general is a pretty rare event in patients coming on to induction therapy, but in general in patients with mild hepatic dysfunction, there's really no need for a change in any of their medications, but in patients with moderate or severe dysfunction, and specifically that's a bilirubin above 1.5 times your upper limit of normal at your institution, you may want to initiate therapy with 0.7 milligrams per meter squared of bortezomib, and then increase to 1 or decrease to 0.5 based on tolerability. Most patients will tolerate 0.7 pretty well, and so escalating the dose is an important part of their treatment regimen. Another consideration is adherence, and as a reminder, if we start patients on bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, it's not just the lenalidomide and dexamethasone that patients will start to take. They'll also take antiviral prophylaxis. They may also take aspirin as well or other antithrombotics. And so we're really beginning patients potentially on 4 new drugs if they begin aspirin, antiviral prophylaxis, as well as lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And so that may be an issue in an elderly population that's already taking multiple medications. And in general, thinking about patients in the continued treatment setting, if patients go on from induction and may go on to transplant or maintenance, as myeloma continues to evolve and as their disease may relapse or be refractory primarily, then patients may start to experience more adverse events as their myeloma worsens, and specifically around renal function. Renal function may not be recoverable later in the disease stage compared to the earlier stage. So in conclusion, I'd like to leave you with these key takeaway points for patients with comorbidities who are beginning therapy for induction of myeloma. Existing comorbidities in these patients should be considered prior to and during treatment with induction of bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, or any other regimen that may be selected based on comorbidities. Those comorbid symptoms may worsen while on therapy, and so we need to be vigilant as patients begin induction therapy, particularly in the first couple of cycles, but also as their myeloma treatment continues. And pharmacists are at critical points and junctures for education of patients, as well as other healthcare team members for managing adverse events, predicting adverse events, and monitoring patients carefully while on therapy. So in conclusion, I'd like to thank you for viewing this activity, and hopefully you'll join other additional programs on managing myeloma in the future. Thank you.